This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Michael Sulick made a living catching spies. Used to be the chief of counterintelligence for the CIA. And you might think that if you had a job like that, you could never talk about it. But in fact, he used to give lectures to his colleagues on that very subject. He liked to use historical examples to demonstrate that espionage and counterespionage have been part of the American story from the very beginning. More often than not, Michael Sulick found that his fellow intelligence professionals were unaware of this history. Somebody should write a book about all this, he thought. So when he retired to Wake Forest a few years ago, he did. Two books, in fact. The first volume, Spying in America, came out last year. It's a survey of espionage from the Revolutionary War to the dawn of the Cold War. And the second volume, American Spies, is due out this fall, and it takes the story up to the present day. Both are published by Georgetown University Press. Michael Sulick spent 28 years in the CIA, most recently as director of clandestine service from 2007 to 2010, and he joins me in the studio now. Michael, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
So you grew up in New York. Did you always want to be a spy?
No, I imagined a number of other things, but I was always interested in foreign travel, and I assumed someday I would wind up overseas doing something.
You ended up studying languages, Russian in particular, but it took you a while to figure out what you wanted to do. I guess your college days were days you spent searching for yourself and your vocation, eh?
Exactly. Well, I left college right in the middle and enlisted in the Marine Corps and did a year in Vietnam. Came back and decided to then enter the Ivory Tower and studied comparative literature. Got a doctorate in that and found out that that made me totally unemployable. So I eventually went to the employer of last resort, the U.S. government.
You studied languages at some point and were attracted to Russian, right? When did you get involved in the study of Russian?
Well, the university I went to, Fordham University in New York, was actually given a lot of money by the government to foster Russian language and area studies. It was in the, you know, the decade after Sputnik and feeling in the government that we were, you know, maybe behind the eight ball. We should do better with languages, especially Russian. And so the university got a lot of money for this. And I went to high school on the same campus, Fordham Prep. So some of the they decided to offer it there. I thought it was something different from Spanish and French, and I had also studied Latin and ancient Greek as well. So I thought
you are ready for the marketplace.
So I said,
man.
"Yeah, Russian." Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I said, "Well, Russian is something interesting," and obviously, I figured it would probably lead to a career somewhere in the U.S. government at some point.
So you did see it somehow as part of a path, and because the U.S. government was interested, you thought, well, this would be something worthwhile.
But after I did comparative literature, I thought I would enter academe, but frankly, the job market was very bad at that time. So.
And those first couple of years of college, you said you didn't quite finish. You weren't quite sure where you were going then.
Right.
So you actually joined the Marines.
That's correct.
Went to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that. What was your job in Vietnam?
Actually, I was in what's called artillery fire direction. Basically, you're the one who uses a slide rule and a protractor and tells the guns how high up to point and how far, left or right. I also did some interpreting, too, while I was there.
You needed to know a little math.
Yes, which I am actually not very good at, but that's,
Eventually, you did more translation, right? You learned the Vietnamese language?
Yes, I studied in the Marine Corps before I went to Vietnam.
How did that go then? I mean, did you get much training? Did you feel like you were fluent in Vietnamese? I wonder how.
By no means. It was only about 4 months. The majority of people who were in the program were infantrymen who were something we call Kit Carson scouts. They basically, when North Vietnamese army were captured, the Marine Corps tried to turn them, so they would report information to us. And then they would go out with these so-called Kit Carson scouts in front of the infantry platoons to areas where we would engage in North Vietnamese.
Did your experience in Vietnam change your worldview at all when you got back to the States?
Yeah. I mean, I found I was against the war. As I said, that's why I think I wanted to withdraw from the world of current affairs and go into the ivory tower of comparative literature.
So that was it. So you do this. You go back to the university. You get a PhD in comparative literature.
Correct.
You did a dissertation on different translations of Hamlet.
Yes. which is about as far from the world of current events as you can get.
Although, in many ways, depending on how you interpret Hamlet, nothing could be more relevant.
That's right. But
why did – when was that – it wasn't just escape. You must have been also attracted. There had to be something about this literature and these comparisons that was also interesting to
you,
right?
No, as I say, I like languages and actually linguistics, you know, the analysis of different languages and so on. And that's what led me to look at different cultures translate a work, especially one as monumental as Hamlet,
right,
which is popular outside the English-speaking world, too.
I mean, that has to be interesting, and I just want to ask you about that. Also, across languages, but then over time in various languages, I mean, cultures have a way, even in English, of moving the valences depending on what's going on culturally with a work like Hamlet, I would guess.
Yeah, and you know, some even if you look at different Russian translations, for example, there are clearly some that were done with political purposes in mind. Things are interpreted so that they would fit the current context and the era in which they were translated.
Right. So now you're an expert in comparative languages. You've looked at different translations of Hamlet. What got you to the CIA?
Well, as I said, I think after a certain amount of time in the ivory tower, I had had enough of that. I thought I had to get my grounded back in the real world. So I got involved in local politics in New York, and I eventually wound up as a staff member to a congressman in New York. Not in his Washington office, but in his district, basically dealing with constituent complaints and community relations and this type of thing. Met my wife, who was also – she was working for a state senator at the time. So we got married, and I said I'd really like to venture out of New York at some point. And one I put in an application for the State Department, and she actually found an advertisement in a newspaper for the CIA, which was, it turned out it was the first time that the CIA had actually started advertising positions in the press. And so I applied and went through the application. I actually went down to a small office in the federal building and downtown Manhattan, and no sign on the door, just a little peephole. They let me in, and I said I was applying for one of the jobs, analyst jobs, which are mostly headquarters-based, not that much travel overseas at that time. And they told me, we don't really have any of those jobs. All we have are operations officers. I said, is that what I think it is? And they said, probably. I said, that's all right. I'll do that, too.
Wow! So you're going to get the trench coat and the hat now, and the bag full of goodies, and go off. And it was an ad in the news. What did the ad say?
I don't remember now. I mean, they were just advertising positions at the CIA, and the CIA again doesn't hire just spy handlers like the place that I were. I mean, they have analysts. There are technical people as well, finance, logistics, lawyers, you name it. So
it's interesting, though, to think that they were looking for not analysts. I mean, so you've got this ad in the paper, mm-hmm. right? Everybody's going to see this. Who are they going to get? I mean, who answers the ad in the paper for join the CIA?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sure they attracted a certain amount of strange types too, but they have a pretty rigorous application process, so they're able to weed them out. And the advertising positions actually really skyrocketed after 9/11. It's much more active now than certainly it was in 1980 when I joined.
Are you still using newspaper ads?
Oh, newspaper, the internet, much more so. And my wife actually worked in the recruiting part, actually did diversity recruiting and went to universities down here, historically black colleges and universities. They have sessions there where they'll bring people from the different branches, analysts, operators, and so on, to explain what the job is really like and what the application process is.
And
like.
I guess diversity for the CIA is not just EEO, but in a way we need people from various cultures.
That's exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, it's not just something to fill quotas or to be diverse, but it helps us overseas. We're looking for Arab Americans for obvious reasons, working in the Middle East, Hispanic Americans, who's Latin America.
So what was you told me what you asked them, can I have an analyst job? What was it like, though? What was their part of this interview? How did that process go?
For this particular job that I was getting in operations, I mean, our job is to go out and try to recruit people as spies. So they're looking for people with, good judgment, social skills, languages, It helps if you've lived overseas and you're not, you know, kind of intimidated by a foreign environment. And people, I guess, with a kind of a steady balance, should I say. I mean, people who come in who really buy into the James Bond view of things don't do so well in that process because, in fact, that's not reality.
If you go in and say, I want to kill them all, chances are you won't get the job.
Yeah, that would probably eliminate you pretty early in the process.
How much did they actually tell you about the job? I mean, he was coy when you said, is that what I think it is? And he says, probably. Could they tell you what you were getting into in that first interview?
One of the things that actually impressed me was that they gave suggested readings to do if you wanted to find out about it. And there was a book out by a gentleman named Phil Agee, who was a CIA operations officer who basically went rogue and worked for the Cubans. He published books with identifying names of a number of CIA officers. But his first book, which was called Inside This, I think, a CIA Diary, and they recommended reading. They said even though clearly they didn't agree with what he did or the publication of the book, it's kind of a day-to-day diary of his life as an operations officer in Latin America. And they said that this part actually is an approximation or of what the job is. And I was actually impressed that they would take a book that they so clearly vilified but said this will give you an introduction to what the job really entails.
Well, you read it and apparently liked what you read because you came back for the next interview and ultimately got the job. Talking to Michael Sulick, former head of counterintelligence and the clandestine service for the CIA. And when we come back, we'll talk about his career and how things have changed in the intelligence world in the last 3 decades. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest today, Michael Sulick, spent 28 years in the CIA, most recently as director of the clandestine service, author of 2 books, Spying in America and his most recent, Out Soon, American Spies. And we'll talk with him now that he is retired and living in Wake Forest. You joined the CIA. And tell us about your training. What kind of training do you have?
Well, we have training in operations, but you mentioned before, the tradecraft of espionage, but also there's a lot of concentration on writing. Writing is very, people ask me what do they look for when they want to hire someone? Well, the writing part is very critical. If you can't, again, unlike the fictional world, you never see James Bond writing anything down because it's boring. But unfortunately, in reality, that is a good part of the job. For us at the CIA, if you don't write it down, it didn't happen. So there was a lot of stress on writing reports, writing factually what you see without, coloring it with your own opinions and so on.
Now, I suspect you have to do a certain amount of filtering or at least understand what kind of culture and background they're coming from, because a fact is not a fact. A fact is also always colored by their context and their cultural understanding. And you knowing something about that might be important when it comes time to analyze and even report what you heard, right?
Yeah, definitely so. I mean, there's some cultures, Russia, I think, for example, I mean, they actually have 2 words for lie, and they're the lies and telling the truth. One is kind of a white lie, and that's dismissed. Another one is a more serious lie. So, you have to take that into account that sometimes people embellish and they don't think that that's, clearly they're not even trying to cheat you, but that's just part of that culture. And then every human being is different too, and some will expand their own role in things. So you have to, just like any, it's very similar to journalism. You have to, what the facts, what did, the prime minister tell you exactly, not what you think he meant.
Yeah. So what was your first assignment?
I was in Tokyo, Japan.
Can you tell us what you were doing?
Most of my career was involved with because I came in with knowledge of Russian, was involved with chasing Soviets.
So. All right. So you're looking for people who are mostly Soviet citizens or foreign nationals who may be trying to get intelligence on the United States.
No, we're trying to get people who have intelligence that will be of value to the United States. Right. As I said, Russia was at that time clearly the main adversary. I spoke Russian, so I would try to engage Russian officials overseas.
Why do people do it? What's the main motivation for anybody to turn secrets about their own country?
There's a number of them. I mean, usually one of the principal ones is money. But as I say, money has no intrinsic value of its own. That's what it gets you. Some people do it out of sheer greed because they want worldly goods. Others do it because they want to finance their kids' education, or just, you know, they want to, you know, escape from their homeland. Others do it for ego. Some because of resentment. They resent their system, or they resent their country, or in some cases they resent their superior and feel that they've been overlooked. Part of it is thrills. Sometimes ideological sympathy with the United States and its goals. And often it's usually with the best ones. It's a combination of some of those motives.
How do you go about finding likely candidates?
When you meet somebody, what you try to do is establish a person. You're cultivating a personal relationship with them, because ultimately, if in fact they do have access to secrets that you're interested in, you're going to ask them to betray either their country or their group that they're affiliated with. So you do want to build up a certain faith in yourself, personal relationship with them, and you see whether, in fact, any of these motives I just mentioned may be present in them. Do they need money? Do they want money for their kids' education or some other reason? Do they resent their country? You know, if it was a Soviet, you know, issues they have with their system, which many of them had, and if so, you try to explore all of those avenues with them in conversation.
Now, the most dramatic stuff of spy fiction, of course, has to do with finding people in compromised positions, or better yet, putting them in a compromised position and saying, now that you're there, now that it appears that you're doing, WordPress. How much of that do you have to do you engineer?
The CIA in the early 50s did try, blackmail, coercion, and it kind of backfired on them. And so then we basically abandon that, because ultimately you want a source or a spy who is cooperating of their own free will. They're going to be more comprehensive in what they tell you, more accurate, whereas somebody who's being blackmailed is going to tell you as they resent the fact that they're in that relationship, they're going to tell you as little as possible. So not only for moral reasons, but for practical reasons, right. Blackmail doesn't suit. So,
yeah, it does seem that when you contemplate the fictional situation like that, you realize pretty quickly that this individual has now been isolated. That has made them valuable to you, but ultimately means they're operating on their own. So your control then is always tenuous and questionable.
Absolutely. But the Russians, on the other hand, the KGB and its successor organizations still use blackmail, and they still feel that is valuable. Even if a person is not that cooperative, the Russians they're much more apt to coerce and threaten and so on to get the person to do what they want. But again, ultimately, you don't have a source who's cooperative.
Talked about this backfiring, and of course, the term is blowback. A pretty famous article in The Atlantic several years ago that talked about how the CIA was involved basically in creating al-Qaeda in Afghanistan when the Soviets had invaded and occupied. It seemed like a good idea at the time to bring together all of these fundamentalists to work at with the geopolitical goal of destabilizing the Soviet Union there, and then we had helped create the very network that came back to attack us. So when an organization like the CIA realizes that this is what's happened, how conscious is the organization of the possibility that what we're doing in the short run can have these consequences, this blowback in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, there is, I think, an issue that, intelligence agencies are working on the crisis of the moment. So at that time, the idea in Afghanistan clearly was to expel the Soviets, lessen their influence in South Asia, and there isn't always a lot of thought given to what happens in the future out there. And often you can't predict that. Things could have come out another way besides.
Well, and it raises the question to me, when I read that article, and I thought to myself, well, who's in charge here? I mean, to some extent, you've got a policy question. We're trying to destabilize, lessen Soviet influence in South Asia. Here's our chance. Do you go to the CIA and say, here's the goal, come up with a plan? Or do you say, look, here's our strategy. We want to do this but avoid that. To what extent does the CIA have a free hand in developing the plan?
Well, the CIA, first of all, it's not a policy-making body, and that's something very important. Other agencies in the national security apparatus, Department of State clearly is, Department of Defense is too. So orally role is to say, this is the capabilities we have and this is what we bring to the table. But most foreign policy ventures can't succeed with the CIA alone. I mean, we've often told that to many administrations, that it has to be a concert of overall U.S. foreign policy tools, if you will, whether it's AID, you know, aid to foreign countries to improve their economies, diplomacy, military assistance, whatever. But the CIA is only, you know, one leg in that multi-leg stool, shall we say.
It's always attractive, I would guess, to people, particularly in with executive power, to say, well, this is this. I don't have to tell people what's going on here. I want to lean on these guys because this is something I could keep secret.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So tell us, you know, it's curious to me, too, how much of the fictional spy ends up in the headlines now and then. I'm thinking about that espionage caper where the Russians, it was back in May, the Russians detained an American embassy worker and claimed he was a spy. And what was interesting to me about this was they sort of turn up this briefcase with a wig and, you know, instructions, a letter with instructions for a potential Russian spy. I mean, this just seems impossible, the idea that he'd have a blonde wig in his briefcase of all things with specific instructions.
Well, this, you know, there have been a number of cases like this during the Cold War. Perhaps people forgot about those because there hadn't been that many recently. But you know, I'm assuming this person was a U.S. embassy worker. I know the U.S. government hasn't acknowledged any of this yet. I guess I'm not surprised as a professional I'm surprised why people in the media seem to be so astounded by the fact the person has a wig. If this gentleman was in fact working in the American embassy and he's out for a clandestine meeting with his source, he clearly doesn't want to run into any Russian who knows him, who then might see him in contact with this person and risk that person's life. So, he forgot to wear his cloak of invisibility. Oh, wait a minute. They haven't invented that yet.
So the point is you really do this kind of stuff, right?
So, yeah, exactly. So I found some of the, you know, and then he had a compass. Well, why would he have that when you have smartphones with GPS and so on? Well, smartphones with GPS can be easily tracked. Right. So, sometimes these simple things work much better.
And instructions. I mean, the idea that you have to write things down and you aren't using telecommunications to actually make agreements to make deals, I guess that makes sense too.
Yeah, and you just can't pick up the phone and say, you know, I gave you the wrong instructions. Why don't you just come on Thursday rather than Wednesday? Because clearly people's phones could be tapped. So for security reasons, that's why things like this are done, if in fact that's what really happened in this case.
So it sounds like a lot of good old-fashioned techniques are still part of spycraft these days.
Very much so.
Well, has the mission of the CIA changed since 9/11, do you think?
Well, certainly. I mean, there was a lot more people going to places like Iraq and Afghanistan. The generation was, I'd say, right before mine had a little bit of this. I mean, they were heavily invested. CIA was heavily invested in Vietnam, just like, of course, the military was. That didn't really happen again on such a large scale after 9/11. So this generation who have entered the CIA after 9/11, in fact, their experience is defined by terrorism and serving in war zones, which my generation really didn't have.
What about the use of intelligence? You know, this is always a question. Vietnam, you know, Westmoreland was sort of clearly hedging some of the information he gave Johnson, understanding he had to fight a two-front war, didn't want to hear how expensive it was going to be. So he kept getting reports. And the complaint was that there was good intelligence coming from the field and that it was modified going out. So between the commander on the field and the commander-in-chief, they weren't getting the good stuff from the ground. Same thing happens again, it would appear, in Iraq, in the run-up to Iraq. We hear about yellow cake. There was intelligence. It wasn't bona fide intelligence, and the intelligence community was trying to tell the president that over and over again. He was selling us a bill of goods. Turns out there was not the connection the president did. What effect does that have on field officers, people in the field, people in the CIA, to understand that their institution is being used for these political reasons?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of the operators are overseas most of the time, and they don't really focus on the politics of the issue as that. And for us, it's culturally, our objectivity is really what's the most important. So, I have to say, most of the people I serve with, you know, we know more about what's going on in the given country that we're in, and we pay more attention to politics there than we do at home. I mean, I often didn't know who was even running in the districts where I was, my official residence was, because I'm focused on the country that I'm serving in. So, for us, the biggest thrill, shall we say, is if I get a piece of intelligence and it goes to the White House and it's briefed to the president. That's the real accomplishment. Now, how that affects the policy, I guess, because we're not involved in policy, doesn't seem to bother us, I think, as much as it might those who are involved in policy, like state or Department of State and Department of Justice.
What do you think happened there? How did that story evolve the way it did?
There were in the first Iraq conflict. As it turned out afterwards, the analysts and CIA and in the intelligence community underestimated Saddam's weapons program. And I think there was a real concern not to do that in the second time. So even aside from the administration or its desires or its policies, those analysts were probably inclined to see that there was a weapons program there. Another thing that complicated the job is, frankly, I think on our side of the House, the operations side, we didn't have sufficient sources to give the analysts the information they needed to make conclusions. And finally, another issue was that Saddam Hussein himself didn't really understand his own program. I mean, because of this fear that he inspired in his own people, there were some who work on these weapon programs who essentially lied to him about what the advances they made because they were afraid of him. So you could have a source next to Saddam who is telling you what he believes to be the truth about their programs, but in fact it really isn't because their people inside their own government are lying to each other out of fear.
In what appeared to be an effort by the Bush administration to do damage control and intimidate the intelligence sources who ultimately exposed the administration for what it did, the administration outed a CIA agent. I wonder what impact that has in the field when, field officers and perhaps your operatives, foreign nationals, see, if politics gets in the way, my name could be in the newspaper. Does that chill your sources for a while?
No, I mean, anytime something like that, the arrest of a spy, he says, well, how do I know you don't have another one in there who's going to reveal my name? The politics revealing the cover of an officer who's undercover also doesn't send a good message.
Dick Cheney kept coming to the CIA headquarters asking over and over for intelligence showing a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. And in the book Hubris by Mike Isikoff and David Korn, you're quoted saying it was like they were hoping to find something buried in the files or come back with a different answer. And you say you thought the CIA's analysts had become overly eager to please. Do you think that had that effect, him showing up every day or every week asking the same question?
No, as I said before, I believe the analysts might have been predisposed to believing that anyway because of what they, their conclusions in before the first Iraq conflict. So I never got the impression, the vice president asked a lot of questions and clearly he wanted to see if there was a connection, but the analysts weren't finding them. So ultimately, and of course, some of the conclusions they did come to later, or some of the sources turned out to be bogus, as we found out.
You had two retirements. The first in 2005, after President Bush appointed Congressman Porter Goss as director of the CIA. Why did you leave?
Myself and my superior had a disagreement, shall we say, with not so much with the director, but with the aides that he brought in. Who were congressional staff that he brought in, who they came from a world where partisan politics is part of the game, whereas in our culture, as I explained before, that really has no meaning to us. In fact, we lose our credibility if we cook our books, because we know that administrations come and go, but agency staffers remain for years and will ultimately suffer if we violate that cardinal tenet of our craft, which is, again, objectivity. Even whether the answers are welcome to the policymaker or not, or whether they're used or not, but that's very important for us to do that. So I think they saw things from a political prism that we don't. And so we found that rather surprising, and there was some intimidation of people, and we just didn't want to stand for it any longer. So,
Porter Goss came and went. You went and came back.
That's correct.
How did they? Why did you come back?
I was asked by General Hayden, to come back and run operations. The officer who was the director of operations had been asked to come back to be the deputy director of the CIA, and he and then Mike Hayden asked me to, and you know, I was feeling of, you know, work left undone when I went before, so I went back.
If you had to analyze, I mean, as when you work for the CIA, a big part of the job is to take this data and try to make sense of it. If you took a look at what that administration was doing, how it used evidence, how it used the media in the run-up to that war, does it add up to you as an administration with a preconceived idea they're going to war and they're just looking for the evidence?
You know, could be, and we don't, you know. Some wondered, you know, why. Well, Saddam Hussein clearly is somebody, you know, who's a brutal dictator, killing masses of his own people. That alone should have been justification to, you know, take him up the scene. But I think there were some who believed you needed stronger justification, and weapons of mass destruction were it. And, you know, ultimately, it just proved not to be the case.
On the State of Things today, my guest, Michael Sulick, who is the former head of counterintelligence and the clandestine service at the CIA. And when we come back, we'll talk about his books about the history of spying in America, all the way back to the Revolutionary War. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Michael Sulick, who spent 28 years with the CIA, most recently as head of the clandestine service. He retired to Wake Forest in 2010 and has written two volumes on the history of spying in America. The second volume, covering the Cold War to present, is going to be out this fall from Georgetown Press. The first, Spying in America, that new one that you can look forward to, American Spies. Why did you write these books?
I was in the head of counterintelligence one time, and jobs like this, you have to give, you know, lectures to the younger officers inside the CIA or in the intelligence community. I like to use historical examples, and I found myself running to a number of books to dig them out, and I wondered, you know, I wished that they had all these cases kind of in a single volume. And they'll be of use to students, and not only students in the CIA, but, you know, college students and laymen, so on. And so during my first retirement, I said, oh, I could write this, because I also had been in academe before and studying for a master's and a PhD. So I knew how to do research, and that's what led to the start of it.
And if there's a single narrative that holds the whole story together, Revolutionary War to present, you would say it's kind of Americans' refusal to believe that Americans would spy on themselves, would turn over information to foreign agents.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think Americans in general are just inclined to accentuate the positive and believe the positive of other people, especially their fellow citizens who, and especially those who are entrusted with, you know, government secrets. But you certainly see in the first 100 years or so where they are, you know, totally blind to this. And but even on into the 20th century, in the 1930s and 1940s, when the Soviets basically riddle the FDR administration and the Manhattan Project with something like that, now we're estimating over 500 spies. I think by the Cold War onset, people are used to this, so they're perhaps less disbelief. But you see it still sometimes. Again, my own organization, the CIA, I know I and my colleagues were shocked. We found out that one of our own, Rick Ames, was a spy. Even though we spy on other people, we try to recruit Russians or Soviets as spies in those days. But we never believed one of our own would do it, but he did. And the FBI had kind of the same shock themselves when Robert Hansen, one of their own, was arrested a few years later.
So, and you say this goes back all the way to the Revolutionary War. We had there was a pretty good intelligence program going on, and then utterly dismantled immediately after the war.
Yeah, that was the American tendency, was that intelligence and counterintelligence, which is, you know, the catching of spies, if you will, was necessary during wartime. But all the people who you know, gained some experience in this, then went off to other pursuits. You know, the person we consider the father of counterintelligence is actually John Jay. So he ran the only counterespionage service, if you will, in the Revolution. It only operated in New York State. He obviously went off to other pursuits after the war. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And that pattern repeated itself again during the Civil War, World War One. Everybody had to create these capabilities anew, you know, until the Cold War started.
And I guess it must have been, or was it, more difficult in the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, where everybody spoke the same language, had the same culture, and really much more difficult to pinpoint who's with you and who's against you.
Yeah, it was, you know, say, easier from the intelligence gathering standpoint because, again, people work side by side, same farms and factories, and actually sometimes even within families too. So it was easy to find people who would give you information. Now, catching those who were spies, of course, that proportionally, that was much more complicated.
In those two conflicts, for instance, were the motives any different? Were people more often motivated by ideology and the cause, let's say in the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, or are those same? Are those other reasons, greed, et cetera?
A lot of them just motivated by ideological sympathy, but there, you know, some of the first spy, if you will, major spy of the Revolution, a gentleman named Benjamin Church. Was a Surgeon General of the Army under Washington, that, you know, cured the wounded at Bunker Hill, but he liked the high life and he had a mistress, so money was his motive. Benedict Arnold was greedy. He needed money. He was in debt. And part of the reason he was in debt because of his contribution to the to the Revolution. But at the same time, for him, the motives were much more complicated. I mean, he felt that he had been overlooked. He had a tremendous ego. He just thought he hadn't been recognized for his exploits. So the money was only one of the many kind of murky brew of motives that compelled him to spy.
Interestingly enough, you say he commanded a lot of money, and that was in a way for him a way to validate how important he was.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a recognition of his self-worth in many respects.
Another interesting thing about Benedict Arnold that you point out is that he turned over some vital information that should have been ultimately damaging to the American cause, and yet, and this is something I think that is telling about the spy business, even though the British had this vital information, didn't do much good.
Yeah, and that's often the case. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but often it depends on how it's used, whether it's – one of the best examples to me is actually not an American case, but the Soviet case, where the Soviets had a very effective spy named Richard Sorge, who worked for them in Tokyo as a very close to the – he was posing as a German journalist, very close to the German embassy, actually was among the first to tell the Russians, to tell his Soviet masters that the Nazis were going to violate the non-aggression pact and attack the Soviet Union. And Stalin felt that, you know, his relationship with Hitler was so strong and the Germans would be too afraid to attack him. He just wouldn't believe this or other information. And, of course, he was proven to be wrong.
And you can turn the whole spy business on its head. I mean, I think Hitler was famous for convincing Stalin using some pretty sneaky tactics to suggest that some of his senior command, Stalin's senior command, were trading secrets with the Germans. They weren't, but Stalin was just paranoid enough to do what Hitler probably couldn't get away with.
No, exactly. Yeah, we take, you know, somebody's inherent inclination anyway and just kind of, you know, enhance that with these stories, and it works.
Civil War, also interesting, competing counterintelligence agencies within the Lincoln administration. Tell us about that.
They essentially, they're the commander of the army, who was appointed by Lincoln, was George McClellan. He had worked on the railroads before that and had met Pinkerton, who was started off his career as, you know, detective work on the railroad. So he hired Pinkerton as sort of his intelligence chief. Meanwhile, about a year later, Secretary of War and hires another gentleman named Lafayette Baker to kind of do the same thing. So Baker, his duties are much more in ferreting out spies. Pinkerton had both collecting intelligence and catching spies. So sometimes the two of them tripped over each other. Baker, as I note in this book, also was the first of many who, I think, created this suspicion in the American people about counter-espionage, you know, because it's been used by other countries in the past as a way to stifle political dissent and get rid of your political enemies. And unfortunately, that was proven to be almost the case in the United States a number of times during our history. And Baker was among the first because he would go out and round up citizens with, you know, no warrants, really no evidence, and you'll lock them up for a period of time without rights and then let them go. He never found any major Confederate spies in the process of doing this.
But you say this did create a backlash. People were aware of it and then became wary of counterintelligence?
I think even from the first settlers were wary of counter-espionage, security, and so on, because, I mean, they had escaped these the royal courts of Europe, which were responsible for oppression, and one part of that was espionage and counter-espionage, arresting spies. And in some cases, those people were arrested not because they were spies, but just because they were political opponents of a particular monarch. So I think that part of the escape to the New World was, we don't want to deal with things like this anymore. Besides that, then you add instances in American history where, in fact, the practice does lean that way. Lafayette Baker was one. Another gentleman named Mitchell Palmer was attorney general, had the so-called famous Red Raids in 1920, rounding up supposed anarchists and socialists, didn't find any spies. J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO or counterintelligence program targeted against Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference and peace movement activists looking for a foreign hand or foreign spies. No major spies found in any of those.
Yeah, but American public opinion swings. You talked about the success of the Soviets in the 30s in particular and the early 40s in nesting spies in the United States. Americans apparently not aware of it. And I guess ideologically, that's before Stalin had become exposed for the tyrant that he was. And so the idea of communism was in play. It was a viable political movement in the 30s. And so less suspicion about the possibility of counterintelligence in this country.
Yeah, well, you had the Great Depression. I mean, it looks like the capitalist experiment is failing. Lots of propaganda from the Soviets of these, gargantuan steel mills churning forth their product. People are also worried about the rise of fascism in Europe and see Stalin as a bulwark against this. So communism is an attractive alternative. And lots of people flock to the New Deal to work in it. And they actually start out as either in universities or as Marxist discussion groups, sitting around in their homes discussing this, and then they then become part of the Communist Party of the United States underground, and then are seeded out into these government agencies where they're spies.
Now, in the post-World War II period, that gets flipped on its head, and then there's paranoia about a communist under every bed, right?
Exactly. The case of the, I'd like to point out where I discuss in the book are the Rosenbergs, of course. I mean, they're spying during, the 1940s. The Soviets have now acquired their own atom bomb, thanks to partly because of secrets Rosenberg gave, Julius Rosenberg gave the Soviets, although he's actually minor overall in the terms of the number of highly placed spies in that project who gave information to them. But in that, the time of their trial, 1951, the Korean War, Mao Zedong in China, Soviets have occupied Eastern Europe. Everything has changed. And the Soviets are no longer our allies. So in that very heated, the anti-Soviet climate of the time, they become the last people convicted of or sentenced to death for espionage.
Is there a direct relationship between our tolerance for, say, invasion of privacy? I'm going to get us right up to the NSA now. Our tolerance for that and our fears about, being penetrated, do they move in lockstep? Do we become less worried about what the government knows about us as we become more worried about the spies among us?
I think there's always a friction, healthy tension that has to exist there. I think the public generally accepts that there are certain things that cannot, even in a free society, that must remain secret to ensure your national security. As long as laws aren't violated and civil liberties aren't violated. So the government accepts that there are somehow checks and balances built in to make sure that that doesn't happen, that we don't experience what happened, let's say, in 18th century Europe, where spy services, again, were used for oppression. Or I shouldn't say 18th century Europe, yep. Soviet Union, 20th
century. Certainly. And again, in a couple of cases in the United States, where espionage agencies, security agencies went well beyond their brief to collect information on Americans. The Obama administration has charged several leakers under the Espionage Act, including Bradley Manning, most recently Edward Snowden, of course. They're not spies in that traditional sense of the word. They didn't leak information to another country. They leaked it sort of to everybody, and they're claiming moral grounds for this. Is this something new?
Well, I think it's new in the sense that we're going to see a lot more leakers, shall we say. I mean, aside from spies, as I write about in the last chapter of my second book, you know, the cyber espionage has, I think, has changed the playing field clearly with espionage. We still, you know, charge people like Snowden is charged under the Espionage Act because the act does say it deals with the passage of classified information to unauthorized persons, not only to foreign powers. But I know I and other of my colleagues in the intelligence community were saying, you know, someday the spy in the future will be the systems administrator, the computer, the IT specialist who has access to, you know, thousands of documents. You know, back when in the 80s, when the case that was very controversial was Jonathan Pollard, and he used to carry suitcases full of material out of his office, and that's actually how he got caught. One of his colleagues thought it was somewhat suspicious. Nowadays, he could just walk out with that in his pocket in a flash drive. So, and that's what you see played out in the Snowden case, if in fact he does possess the, you know, large volume of documents that he does. So,
well, that
that's
raises,
what changes yeah. the equation is the quantity of materials that can come out.
Well, it also raises another question, and that is whether or not, I mean, if you dumped every secret that the Americans had on the whole world all at once, how long would it take to analyze that and find out what's relevant and what's not?
Yeah, that's certainly the case. I mean, it's a problem we have even in intelligence gathering now is people worry about connecting the dots and sharing information. Now there's so much information out there, especially about terrorism, but the problem is filtering. How do you find that dot or that needle in the haystack that really is the one that is a terrorist plot that threatens the United States?
Particularly if you're the bad guys and you know that they do have access to every server in the world, let us say, is available to them, you could put out all kinds of stuff that could have them chasing their tails for a long time to come.
Exactly.
Great to talk with you, Michael.
My pleasure.
Michael Sulick is former chief of counterintelligence and director of the clandestine service for the CIA. His book, Spying in America, covers the history of espionage from the Revolutionary War to the dawn of the Cold War. There's a link on our website, stateofthings.org. His second volume, American Spies, covers the Cold War to the present. That is due out this fall from Georgetown University Press. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.